Session number 8329, reel 3.
Mr. Willis, reel 3. Do you remember the VIPs that you flew, Mr. Willis?
Well, I remember quite a few of them. People like Lord Cowdrey, I remember Lord Sherwood, Mr. and Mrs. J. Wynant, I think he was the American ambassador here, Sir Oliver Littleton, people like Mr. Harriman, General de Gaulle and Prince Bernhard, Queen Wilhelmina, Sir Archibald Sinclair, and a fellow called Louis Gregg, Sir Louis Gregg, I think. And Air Chief Marshal Sir Frederick Bowhill, he was the first Air Officer Commanding Transport Command. I flew him on more than one occasion. Air Vice Marshal Kingston McLowry, perhaps. Admiral Somerville, he commanded the fleet of the Mediterranean. And the HIH, the Duke of Gloucester, and Captain Harold Balfour. Air Commodore Lloyd, Air Commodore Wigglesworth, Air Commodore Warren Brown, HRH Princess Royal, that's Princess Mary, Air Chief Marshal Sir Ludley Hewitt, he was Inspector General of the Royal Air Force, King Peter of Yugoslavia, the Prime Minister of Yugoslavia as well, I think. Then King George II of the Hellenes and Mr. Peter Fraser, New Zealand Prime Minister, and General Puttock and... The Right Honourable Anthony Eden, the Right Honourable Winston Churchill, Mrs. Churchill, Mary Churchill, and Miss Churchill. I think that was Mary Churchill, was it? General Sir Maitland Wilson. That was interesting because I remember flying Jumbo Wilson, his nickname was. I flew him from Italy back to London to some council or other, and then back again to Italy without the people in Italy knowing he'd been off. That was immediately prior to the South of France invasion, I think. Then Field Marshal Sir Harold Alexander. Yes. Field Marshal Sir Alex, that's right, Alexander, General Alexander. He became General, didn't he? And then Air Marshal Whitaker and Air Marshal Lord Londonderry, General Burroughs, and Mrs. Freyberg, and she was the wife of General Freyberg of New Zealand, VC. Then Sir Walter Citrine, and a lot of Russian delegates, and Admiral Somerville. Oh, I've got him down before, I think, yes. And Lord Leathers, and Sir Metcalfe, Lord Halifax, Lady Halifax, and so on. That's an example of some of the VIPs that we were flying at that time. And they all had some function in the war, had to go somewhere because of the war, whether it's as far away as the Crimea or whether it's only just up the road, you know, they all had a function somewhere. Of course, a lot of them went to the Potsdam Conference, and I flew a lot of the senior staff there. I went there a couple of times. And of course, we had a lot of aeroplanes in the flight, all different types of aeroplanes, you see. But the aeroplanes that I flew were things like Oxford Ensign, Blenheims, Beaufighters, Defiance, Spitfires, several of the DH aeroplanes, and that's de Havilland aeroplanes, including the Flamingo, and aeroplanes like Hudson's and Lockheed 12A's, the Fokker 22, which we pinched from the Germans, I think. Then were the New Yorks and Dakotas and so on. I mean, I flew a whole lot. And then, of course, a whole lot of training aeroplanes. So I suppose I must have flown 20, 30 different aeroplanes during the war.
Did you have a favourite?
Well, yes, I think everybody liked the big American aeroplanes, like the Skymaster. And that was a nice aeroplane. The Dakota was very good. The Hudson was very good. It was a good, reliable aeroplane. The British aeroplanes, well, they were all right, but they weren't developed so much, and they didn't have the same equipment like de-icing and things that a transport pilot needs. You see, we didn't have aeroplanes that were built for quite the same work as the American.
Were there any particular types that you personally would avoid?
No, you never did that. Any experienced or competent pilot wouldn't be defeated. He would fly an aeroplane, so he wouldn't say, I'm not going to fly that. Oh, no, he wouldn't do that. Now, any aeroplane that came my way, I flew, and a lot of them I flew voluntary just to fly them to see what they were like. But when I talk about British and American aeroplanes, I'm not talking about their operational performance, because we had aeroplanes which were operationally more suited for our work than the Americans. But, on the other hand, the American aeroplanes were always very well made. You know, they were made of metal, and they had de-icing and various, prop de-icing and various qualities for going through weather, which our aeroplanes perhaps didn't have. But, of course, we've caught up with all that nowadays. But, you know, we're going back a long time, aren't we? Did you want to know about the thing called a short snorter? Is it time to say that?
Yes.
Well, this was only a thing which actually was started with me by King Peter of Yugoslavia. There was in existence a sort of unwritten code, if you like, between pilots that, I think it started in America, that if you were challenged, saying, you know, are you a short snorter, and you said yes, you had to have your short snorter note with you, which was either a $5 or $10 and a $5 note, or it had to be, it could be done on a pound note. And mine was done, as I only had a pound note available. King Peter started the short snorter for me. I signed his and he signed mine. And then after that, of course, I discovered a lot of the senior people, including Churchill, the Prime Minister. He knew about this short snorter thing, and he used to carry his. So he used to say to pilot sometimes, you've got your short snorter. And the pilot would say, oh, yes. You know, they'd sign each other's, you see. And in that context, I collected quite a few signatures, including, well, as I say, King Peter of Yugoslavia. Then came King George II of the Hellenes and Prince Bernhard and Mr. Peter Fraser and General Puttock and Anthony Eden, General Burrows. I think he was a Russian fellow. And then General Sir Maitland Wilson and General Alexander and Winston Churchill, Lord Leathers and Lord Halifax. So I collected quite a few top people, as you might say, on my own short snorter. Which is only just a silly thing, but it's a memento of the war, you know, which one is inclined to hang on to.
Were all your passengers VIPs, or were there?
Well, generally speaking, if they weren't VIPs, they all had to fly in an important capacity. I mean, if they were divers going out to Malta, or if they were people who had to go, you know. But I would say, generally speaking, in my case, as a fairly senior captain of the squadron, all my passengers, generally speaking, were, yes, I suppose you could say they were VIPs. Now, I can't say all, because I flew several thousand passengers, but I would say that a large number of the important flights, like Yalta and so on, all my passengers in those cases were VIPs. But, of course, we very often did routine flying, like during the we did a daily service to Belfast. Well, they weren't all VIPs, obviously, but they were all people going there on some war function or other. So we used to have a daily flight, and every now and then I'd take one of those services myself, you see. So I wouldn't say they were all VIPs, no, they were people who just had to go there. So
you once went to Malta to collect some children.
Well, I don't say I went there to collect children. I had a job to do to go to fly to Malta, and coming back, staging post manager, I suppose you call him a staging post manager, wanted these children to be flown to Gibraltar. So I took them, certainly, yes. I mean, I was going back with no specified load, so I took whatever I was asked to take. And I did take a lot of children back to... who'd had a pretty rough time, you see, in Malta. They hadn't got all the facilities there, and some of them had to go into hospital. I think they all had to go into hospital for some treatment or other. So I took that lot, yes.
You were flying, presumably, a single aircraft, not as part of a fleet. Did you ever come into contact with German fighters?
No, we didn't. Not in conflict, no. We used to sometimes see it. I mean, North Africa, for instance. I mean, I remember once seeing one of their aeroplanes flying a long way below me, but I was fairly convinced he hadn't seen me. Otherwise, I'd have taken evasive action. But we did carry two front guns in the Hudsons. Yeah, we had two front guns, which were always loaded on the Hudson aircraft only, and they were the ones that we pushed more into operational areas, you see. So we did have a minor second chance. I don't think any of us could use the guns very well, but, you know, we'd probably have a bash if it came our way. But no, it wasn't our job to engage the enemy. Certainly not. It was our job to fool the enemy, to get in and without him knowing, or to go anywhere without him knowing. In no way were we engaged in giving the enemy a bash. But we had to progress the conduct of the war without being shot down. I mean, it would be a hell of a black if you got yourself shot down with a few VIPs on board. I mean, that was to be avoided. But, of course, to do that, we had to take on, other little risks, like flying 200 miles out over the Atlantic to come back to England because we didn't want to be intercepted, and so on. Because we always knew when the German night fighters were out, when we were doing Gibraltar, London, because they had a radio signal which was transmitted called Consul, and that was a navigational aid to the German aircraft, to their Condors. They had big aircraft called Condors, and they used to patrol the areas because they knew we were communicating, and they used to patrol that area. But of course, every trick we could use, we knew when they were transmitting the signal, we knew that they were out or airborne. But of course, because of that, we wouldn't maintain exactly the same route as last time. We would vary the route, we'd vary the height, we take full use of cloud cover and so on. So in every way, we avoided getting into contact with the enemy, because it would be a bit of a... We did lose one or two aeroplanes, and we don't know how. But, it wasn't our duty to, with a load of passengers on board, to start engaging German aircraft.
How big a problem was fuel capacity when you had to go out of your way like this?
Well, this was something which was always a worry. Fuel was a worry, but we carried enough reserve to do... I mean, any competent captain would carry enough reserve, and the fuel, your range, would be a part of your problem, and you'd have that... you would consider that. We had enough incidents occur, like, such as engine failure and so on, without, making our job more hazardous by engaging the enemy. We, for instance, in the York aircraft, I had many engine failures when I couldn't complete the flight. I had one, for instance, flying Gibraltar, London on the sea route, the Atlantic route. We just went westward out of the Atlantic 100 or so miles, and then went north, and then back east again. I had a York engine catch fire. The header tank failed and the glycol caught fire. That had to be stopped and feathered. And number one wasn't running very well, so that was a bit, a bit uncomfortable. Then another one I had, I remember flying direct from London to Cairo, a long flight that hadn't been done before. And somewhere over the French Alps or near there in that area, I had a number two motor blow up, had a valve failure, and it blew up, had to feather it at once. And that was unfortunate because I had a VIP on board, and was unfortunate because I couldn't complete the flight, and no way could I get to Cairo, so I had to force land at Malta. And but it was unfortunate in as much as we were at 10,000 feet, or a bit above, I think, and... the number two motor was the motor that heated the aeroplane. So with that one feathered, it got extremely cold. And before we landed, I mean, half the passengers had almost got frostbite.
Were there heating facilities within these planes?
I have said, number two engine was the one that did the heating in this aeroplane. But with it feathered, with it stopped, there was no heat. So they got pretty cold very rapidly. I mean, the temperature just dropped right down to well below, a long way below zero. But, oh yes, most of the aeroplanes, you had to have heating, because on the Iceland run alone at 10,000 feet, we were at least 12 degrees centigrade below zero at that height. So we had to have heating, yeah. The heating was a bit inadequate, actually. I mean, the heating didn't bring it up to a comfortable heat as we know it today, you know, sort of 70 plus. The heating, we were lucky if we could get it 5 or 10 degrees above zero, but at least it was endurable. But, oh yes, we had to have heating on Hudsons and Dakotas and Yorks, and most aeroplanes had some form of heating, you see, had some form, because...
Did you have to pay any attention to weight ratios when you were carrying passengers?
Well, there are two things with regard to weight. One was where you put it, in other words, the CG position of the aeroplane. CG means the centre of gravity. We had to have the centre of gravity in the right place, so the loading of any aeroplane is very important, so as to get the CG position in the right part of the aircraft. It had a certain tolerance, both forward and aft, but the CG had to be observed, and that was the final responsibility of that was the captain. And then the all-up weight. Well, of course, if you exceeded the all-up takeoff weight, if you did that, you then overloaded the aeroplane, then you affected the performance of the aeroplane. For instance, if you had a Dakota and you exceeded, say, 24,000 pounds all-up weight, anything above that, you would reduce its single-engine performance. So it would mean that immediately after takeoff, you wouldn't have a single-engine performance. But for operational reasons, we used to exceed it. I mean, we would go up to 28,000 pounds, a weight at which we could get the aeroplane off the ground, but you couldn't fly with one engine. But if it was operationally necessary, then we would do it. But otherwise, with VIPs and passengers and that sort of thing, we tried to observe the weights, the all-up weights, for which the aeroplane was originally designed.
Would passengers have to be weighed?
No, we didn't. We did sometimes weigh them if we were right on the maximum limit. We sometimes did, but generally speaking, we took all passengers as weighing 200 pounds, and we reckoned that averaging it out, that was about right. So if we had, say, 20 passengers, then they were assessed as 200 pounds each, you see. So we put on the load sheet 200 pounds. And although a lot of passengers were over that weight, an awful lot were under. So that was a rough and ready method we used in those days. But we had to observe the CG position always. Otherwise the aeroplane wouldn't fly, you know, it would be uncontrollable.
You say you could be called out at times from bed even to go on a flight. Were there any maximum permitted flying hours?
No, that's called flight time limitations. We had no flight time limitations in our squadron at all. We used to go right up to the maximum fatigue of that particular aircrew. I mean, sometimes I'd be on duty for as long as 36 hours, not flying all that time, but I might do two flight stages, and the time in between and preparation and all the rest of it could last for a long time. No, there were no flight time limitations. We used to fly right to the limit of fatigue and put up with it, which I think was common in the Air Force in those days. But, of course, most of the flights in the Air Force were well within one's capacity, you know, because if you did a single flight, if that flight was with me coming back from the Azores, for instance, it was a long flight. It was 8 hours, I think. Then you might be on duty maybe for 10 hours in that case, a couple of hours before the flight in preparation and then the flight time. But generally speaking, the flying hours didn't exceed your fatigue tolerance. Didn't. But if it did, then you'd put up with it. You know, you'd just do it. So. But it was only later in civil flying that the flight time legislation was... It was only in civil flying after the war that legislation came in that would limit your total flying hours or duty hours, and in fact it limited your total hours per month or, and your total duty hours per day, you know, within 24 hours. So that was done for safety reasons, really, because there were one or two accidents after the war which were caused by fatigue, so they quickly rectified all that.
Were there any cause, any that you know of in the war, caused by fatigue?
Not to my knowledge, no. Not to my knowledge. I mean, people were pretty whacked out when they came back to England from the Mediterranean, having probably done two flight stages. They just went straight to bed, or they were just debriefed and then went straight to bed.
What were the off-flying duties of these pilots?
The what?
The off-flying duties. Duties when they were not actually flying.
Well, in my case, I was a flight commander. I had to administrate a whole flight of aircraft, which is a third of the whole squadron. And my squadron commander, you see, had three flight commanders. And each of those flight commanders were responsible to him for the three flights. I had a multi-engine flight. And, I had to administer the flight. That is to say, I had to organise all the maintenance schedules, have them all up on the wall, so I knew the serviceability state of all aircraft. I had to be responsible for the fitness and the training of all my air crew, that they were all updated with their requirements, that they had done so many night landings and so on, so they weren't out of practice. And I had to make sure that they were all on form and available, and these were all done by putting charts up on a wall, you see, which are amended by your staff all the time as aircraft came in and went unserviceable, so that was taken off, showing unserviceable. So at one glance, if you're on the telephone, you could look at the wall and know the serviceability state of all aircraft and all your crew as well, how many crew were available, whether they were on rest or whether they would just come back and were not available, or whether they were on leave and so on. So all your serviceability state of aircraft and crew were all set up on a wall, at least that was my way of doing it, in chart form, you see. And then I used to run other charts, training charts, to make sure that every air crew had done a ditching practice and this practice and that, you see. Otherwise you'd be sending people over the water who weren't up to date on their gear and ditching procedure and everything else, you see. So that was just part of running a flight. So I had those duties to do as well as flying. And I, as a personally, I was in a position where I could more or less choose the flights that I did. But on the other hand, my CO and the air council as well used to dictate very often that they had wanted a certain flight done, and they would dictate that I did it. Very often, even a signal from the air council used to mention my name, you know, some particular flight, and the pilot will be so-and-so if available, sort of thing. So I did, because of my reputation, I was assigned certain flights that they wanted me to do, so I had to carry that, of course. But
What part did you play in the liberation of Europe?
Well, I did the famous liberation flight to Paris of Churchill, and De Gaulle went over first, but on the same, within a few days of Paris being liberated, they had a sort of liberation day, didn't they? When everybody went to the streets and cheered and everything, and I took Churchill over, including Mrs. Churchill and Mary Churchill, and a whole lot of other VIPs.
Did you stay for the celebration?
Oh yes, I was wandering around the streets in Paris, yeah, oh yeah. And then after that I flew Churchill from a place called Juvencourt, to have a look at the battlefronts and things, and home. He was very keen on... Churchill didn't mind flying at all, you know, he would always... He did much more flying than people think. I mean, he wanted to have a look at various towns from the air and things, one of the towns that were reduced to absolute rubble, you know, like Frankfurt and so on. And the staggering thing is that I went there 10 years after the war, and the whole town was completely rebuilt. You know, even the old part of the town with the old little bricks and everything else. Germans are absolutely amazing how they rebuilt Germany after the war.
But you would have flown Churchill over these areas.
Oh, yes.
The war.
Yes, I can. I did fly Churchill on one particular flight. He wanted to see something or other. on the way back from the Paris flight, actually, on that occasion. I didn't fly Churchill very much myself. We had a more or less had one crew more or less standing by for him all the time in his Skymaster. Roosevelt gave him a Skymaster for himself, you see, for his own flying, and he more or less flew in that. And I was a bit too senior to be allotted just to that flight only, because it would mean sitting around for a long time, just sort of waiting to fly that particular thing. And I had to run my flight and all the other pilots. So I did fly Churchill, really, only on about a couple of occasions. But of course, as a squadron, we flew him on pretty well all his flying. Oh, yes, we didn't... I don't think as far as I know, he hardly flew with anybody else except our squadron. So, we had a special yacht prepared for him first, with a crew assigned for that purpose. And then, later on, he had a Skymaster, which was given by Roosevelt. And then... I don't think he flew on much else. Oh, yes, he flew on a special VIP Dakota or DC-3, which we had, which I flew. And that's about all, I think. He flew in just those aeroplanes. But to the Potsdam Conference and the Yalta Conference, Churchill flew in his own DC-4. Which was a Skymaster. An aeroplane which I did fly, but I didn't fly him in it, you know. He was flown by his own crew, which was a member of our squadron. So, that's about it, isn't it?
What did you do at the end of the war?
Well, after the war, when things started grinding to an end and the operational flying requirements were sort of being reduced. I suppose it was after the second flight to Potsdam when we noted more, when we came more to the end of the war. The first flight, you see, was with the Conservative... Well, I think it was a coalition government was in power, and we flew Churchill there. Well, then, in the middle of the Potsdam Conference, which was more or less the end of the war, in the middle of the Potsdam Conference in Berlin... we changed government to a Labour government. And so the next time we went there to complete the conference, we took Attlee, you see, which among the aircrew would have been unpopular, actually. Anyway, we flew him there and then back. And then after that, I don't think we did any more conferences. We didn't. And the 24th Squadron started breaking up a bit. They kept all the small aeroplanes in a new squadron called the Metropolitan Communications or something. And the 24th Squadron was reassigned to having bigger aircraft, I think. And
you say 24th Squadron was reassigned?
Well, yes, at the end of the war, they broke up the duties in the squadron a bit. They formed another squadron called Metropolitan Communications, I think. And then... I think the real work of 24th Squadron went on to bigger aircraft, and I believe moved to Abingdon or somewhere, where I lost sight of it, and I was posted to another squadron called Squadron... I was posted in 1945 to 246 Squadron at Holmesley South, and it was known as a special flight down there. And there I flew Yorks, Liberator, and the Skymaster, and we didn't do very much more work after that, which would relate to the war. It was after that that I came out of the service and went, in 1947, I went into number 8 Reserve Training School. I think it was called Elementary Flying Training School. To continue reserve flying, and this school was at Woodley, near Reading. And I was assigned back to the RAF VR, RAF Volunteer Reserve, in 1947, and just continued my reserve training there right up to 4 years later, it moved from Woodley to Fair Oaks near Chobham, and then from Fair Oaks it moved to Redhill. Moved to Redhill. And then in 1951 or so, at Redhill, the reserve came to an end, and that ended my service with the Royal Air Force.